I am Heidi Schneider, and happy to see so many of you here today. The title of this session is All the World's a Stage, Acting Shakespeare's As You Like It. And it's the second part of a series which started yesterday. And in yesterday's session, we talked about the play As You Like It more specifically in terms of themes in the play and a little bit about the way the Elizabethans looked at the world. So I kind of looked at it like an introductory English course to As You Like It, and that was the background yesterday. But today I want to focus a little bit more on how plays were acted at the time of Shakespeare, and talk a little bit about the Globe Theater itself, and have you think a little bit about how a play like As You Like It would have been staged in Shakespeare's time. And I just left a staff meeting, and I think this is an appropriate time to let you know, those of you who are new to the village, that we're going to have a Renaissance fair here on Wednesday of this week, and the whole day is being set aside to Renaissance festivities, and it sounds like it's just going to be so much fun. We're going to start out in the morning with a parade, and throughout the day there will be artisans out on the green. We'll have music and hopefully some dancing. There will be maypole. There is going to be any number of activities that people can be involved in. If you're interested in playing a character, some people have wisely brought costumes into the village. I understand the village has a costume shop. If you'd like to put together a costume for yourself, that would be great. You'll be hearing more about this in announcements coming up, but it just coincided so well with what both Michael and I are teaching right now, and I would like to lead a couple of scenes of As You Like It. So if any of you are interested in doing a short scene from As You Like It, we're not going to put on the whole play, so don't panic, but if you're interested in just reading back and forth, probably there'll be 2-3-person scenes, something like that. So if any of you are interested in that, I'd be thrilled to work with you on that and then have that happen this next week. But we won't, obviously, unfortunately, I guess, obviously or unfortunately, be able to put it on in Shakespeare's style, but that's what I'm going to focus on today, is how the play As You Like It might have been staged back in Elizabethan times. So there are basically two things I want to look at today. First is the Elizabethan stage itself and how it was developed, and then I'll spend a little bit of time on how the play was probably acted, like with physical actors. So to start out, when you think about what drama is, you can really boil it down to an actor and an audience. And that's when you just think about any kind of essential theater, it has to do with maybe even just two people, but frequently it's more than that. But there's the actor and there is the audience. And it's just if you just think of that as the very essential element of theater, you begin to get a sense of what's really behind what goes on when you see a play, regardless of where it's set or where it's staged. And when you talk about an actor and an audience, you're beginning to talk about something else going on there, and that is a sense of power or a sense of energy. I don't know if any of you have been in the position that I am in right now, or if you've ever kind of stepped out of a crowd and begun to present something, but that's the kind of dynamic I'm talking about. And the sense there can be described in all kinds of ways. It's nervousness, there's a sense of anticipation, there's certainly an energy that goes on before something is put on. And I think a lot of what the actor's skill has to do with is harnessing that energy or that nervousness or that anticipation and turning it into theater. But you always have to think about what that energy or that tension is all about. And it's always, I think it's always there in a real performance. Also, if we're pairing it, we're just getting down to the very basics of theater. There are about four things that actors use as tools that belong to them. You can probably think of what those are just off the top of your head. Number one is the voice, use of the voice. And as kind of an adjunct to that would be instruments. Very early actors were often minstrels as well. So if you can think back to that kind of theater, the minstrel, someone who's playing for an audience. So it's the voice or instrument. The next is gesture or movement. So again, we're thinking of an actor as maybe a dancer. The third thing would be appearance, how the actor looks. This not only means how tall someone is or how wide someone is, but their costume, which is also an essential element of theater, how the actor is attired or if the actor is just wearing a mask. And then the fourth tool that an actor possesses is properties. It could be a sword, could be a staff. It could be whatever they carry on with them. So, again, we're talking about very essential theater. These are really the only elements that you need to have drama take place. And, of course, assuming that you remember, the audience is the other essential element. There are also some external things that happen in order for a play to be created. And those external tools that I call them tools, one has to do with the place or where the drama is set, the environment. The second is the background. And when you think about background, maybe you think of scenery. That's typically what happens. That doesn't have to be there, but it's often an element in the drama. And the last one is the stage itself, where the actor stands in relation to the audience. And I think we typically today think of something raised as the place where the actor stands. So there's usually maybe a level difference between the actor and the theater itself. So with that kind of general background in mind about the very essential for stripping it back to just the basic elements of theater, that's what we have. And I'm going through to show you how we get to the sort of stage that Shakespeare had, because it had all of these elements in it. The very earliest performances that we know of were kind of ritual performances, maybe in terms of ceremonies having to do with healing, or probably religious ceremonies, again, where you had maybe a healer or a medicine person come out dressed in a costume, maybe it's night, if you can imagine a fire, and some sort of mystical experience happening with the audience. That would be the very first type of theater. And what went on there, what are the elements there? Just what we've talked about. And the thing that creates all the other things in the theater has to do with the imagination, what the audience is able to create themselves. They have to do everything themselves. Maybe the only thing that is given to them is the actor in a mask, or the actor in a costume. And everything else, the scenery, the background, the stage, all of that is part of the imagination of the audience. So that's step one. Then the next, kind of the next level up on the ladder in terms of what happens in theater were religious plays. And maybe some of you have seen, they're not performed very often, or maybe you've read kinds of plays that were put on, for instance, in the Middle Ages called mystery or miracle plays. The people who were blacksmiths or worked with metal would get together and they would act out the part that had to do with nailing Christ on the cross, because it was kind of an advertisement for what they could do because they made the nails. Or the people who worked with wood would also be involved with those scenes, and it got kind of tied into their regular professions. But these were people who didn't act for a living. They were people who got together to put on a play, particularly in terms of a religious celebration. And those scenes also typically were in processions, and they would move throughout the town, and people would parade along with the play as it was being put on, and they'll stop maybe in a courtyard or in front of someone's house, and part of a scene would take place there, and then the play would process on to another part of the village, and the next part of the scene would take place. And so more and more people would be gathered in. It was very participatory, and I imagine very improvisational as well. It seems like more and more people were probably getting involved as the experience went along. Another type of action that is similar to this had to do with something called medieval pageant wagons. And I think even the name suggests what was going on there. people would build like a float, and it was called the pageant. And they would wheel that float. Sometimes they maybe would have a horse carrying it, or maybe the people themselves would cart this float around and set it down in a particular place, and the float would be the backdrop for a scene. And then they would act in front of the scene there. So it's still the procession idea. It was mobile. You could move it around. But more of a fixed structure this time, because we have the background behind it, which was this float or the pageant wagon. Okay. This is kind of very early type of theater, and you can tell, again, imagination had a lot to do with what was going on, because we don't have a fixed stage yet. But the next stage that would happen in the history of theater is the development of professional theaters. This is when you suddenly get a troupe of people who actually act for a living. And you can probably imagine the advantages and disadvantages of this. I'll throw out a disadvantage first, which is that suddenly the actors are distant from you. They're not people in your community that you know. Maybe you're not going to participate as much. It's kind of like them. They're going to do it for us rather than we're going to put this on together, which is what's going to happen with the Renaissance Fair. We're going to put that on together. But as soon as you professionalize something, it places a certain distance between the actors and the audience. Now, the advantage of that, I suppose, is that these people became very skilled at what they were doing. So maybe, in some sense, the theater itself was heightened. The types of people that would go around and do this kind of thing often had bad reputations throughout the ages. I think in some ways actors still don't have the best reputations in the world, but they would come into town generally with much fanfare and celebration, and they would park their carts in front of, say, the courtyard of an inn. A typical gathering place where they knew they would see a lot of people. And it wasn't that different from the pageant wagon, except now we actually have a professional company. And maybe they would have their wagon painted like a float, but more likely than not, they just parked the wagon off to the side and had the costumes and the properties on it. And they would just set themselves up in front of the inn and put on a play there in order to generate some interest. Another common place for theater to take place in those days, and we're talking now just kind of the period that's almost overlapping when Shakespeare was writing, were in manor houses or in the houses of the landed gentry, who would invite these people in to come and act for their guests, for instance. And they'd give them a place to sleep and maybe give them meals for a couple of days, and the actors would have a place to stay. And in turn for doing that, they would put on a show for the people in the manor. And I love this room because this is set up very much like, I imagine, a typical manor house, let's say in England or France, would be, where the meal was served. And if you can imagine this, typically you'd have the room back here, which led to the kitchen, let's say. And maybe you had a balcony up above, which led to the back portions of the house. But this would be the front, and typically in the manor house you'd have these long tables, maybe sitting on either side, and maybe the lord of the manor had his head table back here, kind of facing the kitchen. And so the actors would set up their play right in front here, right in front of the kitchen, and we have actually letters and descriptions of plays that were put on in manor houses. And often the actors would place a screen right in the front to mask the servants coming and going from the kitchen so that there would be less distraction, and there would be two doors, let's say, right here. And the actors would come and act in front, and we have the people sitting on three sides like this. And maybe there's a balcony up above, so you can have some action happening up and down like this. In all of these cases, I hope you're getting the sense that the actor is real close to the audience that he or she is playing with. And I think, again, we have that you know, it's not them and us, it's all of us together experiencing what's going on.
Is it common and similar for the non-English tradition?
For non-Western?
Well, like, not non-Western, but what I guess then would have been Teutonic and Northern European and
yes, yes, yes. All these different things I'm talking about are, have to do with that whole area. Yeah, it was very similar. And in fact, I misread your question, but this is also true in Asia as well, that we have examples of theaters that were set up in similar ways. Because the hierarchical structure existed in China and in Japan as well, and the idea of moving of acting troops that moved around is an ancient tradition that has existed for a long time, just pretty much globally. Even in Africa, there are examples of people who came into villages and put on plays in front of grass huts, and we have drawings of some of that taking place. So it's a pretty common tradition that happened. I think the step that happened right before Shakespeare's theater was developed was something called the booth stage. And I have a picture of a booth stage here, an etching, which was done in 1616, I think. And it's kind of small, and I will let you take a look at it afterwards. But they have the picture of the cart, and there's an actress sitting on top of the cart, and there's the minstrel with the big... it looks like he has a lyre on the back of his on his back, and they have set up just a platform in front of the courtyard of probably the local inn. There's a platform, and there is a scene, just a big square in the back, scenery in the back, and so the actors are elevated, and that kind of stage was called a booth stage, because typically in the back you had some sort of an area behind the scene where the actors could go and change their clothes or keep their property. And if you're using your imagination again, you can see it's not that different from the pageant wagon that I was talking about earlier. You still have this enclosed area in the back where the actors can hide, and then they can also doubly use that as some sort of scenery or as part of their set. So it all comes together there. And yet they're still out in the open, and you can see the people are gathered around the stage area. So again, it's a very intimate thing. All right. At last, we get to Shakespeare's theater itself. And I have, I have an etching of one of the Elizabethan theaters in this book, which I will pass around when I get done using it. But the Elizabethan theater has many of these elements that I have described already. One of the things that we know about, maybe you've even seen pictures. Can people see the yellow at all?
I'll get it black for next door.
The theaters were octagonal for some reason. I don't even know how to count that many. So, but you'll get the general idea. It's kind of a circle, and the audience sat all around in here. And the area where the audience sat, now these are actually seats, was covered over, so they didn't have to sit out in the rain. But this center section of the theater, right in here, is all open to the air. Then the stage, and this is somewhat similar to the booth stage, was just elevated and set out there right in front. And as we know it, they typically had pillars kind of out in the center of the stage, and over this was a roof to cover up the actors. Now, it's not entirely clear if, from some of the etchings that we have of the theaters, it looks like the audience actually could have sat up here behind the stage as well. But it seems clear that at least on the first level, and this was a multi-level theater, some of them were two or three stories high, at least on the first floor, was like the old booth stage or the old pageant wagon. It was the enclosed area where the actors could go in the back and hide, change costumes, change props, put on their makeup. It was called the tiring house, and I don't know exactly what that means, but to me it seems like the actors could retire there to get off stage. But also the Tiring House acted as a backdrop for the rest of the stage. Now, a couple of other things that happened in the Elizabethan Theater that we haven't talked about before was that they added a trap door in the front. And because this stage is raised, it was possible, I suppose, for people to creep around underneath. And when you have a trap door, you can do all sorts of fun things theatrically with that. If you're putting on a play like Macbeth, you can have your witches maybe creep up from underneath the stage. If you're playing Hamlet and you've got Yorick's skull, you can reach down into the grave and that kind of thing. So having a trap door on the stage added all sorts of new dimensions. And the having a roof over it not only protected the actors from the rain, it also defines the space in a way. But one of the things the Elizabethans loved to do was to put on kind of spectacular special effects, including record show, having such things as chariots coming down from the ceiling carrying gods or goddesses. And in As You Like It, in the last scene, the god Hymen comes down and blesses the marriage of the four characters. And although I haven't read about how that was staged, I can well imagine that in a real sophisticated kind of Elizabethan theater, they might have had some sort of chariot float Hymen down onto the stage. So this allowed for some mechanical stuff to go on up here. This roof allowed them to have some sort of mechanical contraptions to do that kind of thing. Now, this is another part of the Elizabethan theater that we often don't think about. We don't have this opportunity so much today. But this open area down here was a place where people could stand. All in here. This is all open. And probably at one time, the actors even used this space as something to act on. That would have made sense back in the days of like the booth stages and whatnot, that the actual ground below, the actors used that, and maybe they used the stage as well to provide those different levels. But in Elizabethan times, this area was for the groundlings, they were called. And the groundlings were just people who didn't want to spend enough money to get a seat under the covered area. And I don't remember how much they paid, but it wasn't very much money. I think I heard in excavating one of the theaters that they found pieces of peanut shells down here in this area, which indicates that maybe, it seems to me it might have been kind of like going to a ball game, that you went in and you brought your food along and maybe they sold peanuts down here in this area, and people could stand right up here next to the stage and actually kind of participate in what was going on the stage, whereas those people who were looking for a more aesthetic experience, I suppose, actually bought seats in the gallery.
Could be the term peanut gallery came from?
Could be. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. The other thing about the Elizabethan theater makes perfect sense if you think about it, is that they didn't have electric lights and that kind of thing. So the plays were put on in the middle of the afternoon. And that's another reason that it seems to me a little bit like a ball game, that you go in the middle of the afternoon to see a play and maybe stand down there right next to the actors and throw peanuts at them if you didn't like them, or they said something in the wrong way. So the stage was lit by sunlight. And so again, it would be important to have a ceiling or a roof over the stage, and these people who might not want to get rained on in the middle of the afternoon could be covered up as well. But the groundlings had to take the weather for what it was, I guess. The theater also was small. In doing some research on this, maybe you understand the dimensions better than I do. I don't know exactly how wide this room is, but at least one of the theaters that they've excavated, this area from here to here was 55 feet wide. And this stage right in here was 43 feet across. So it's a fairly intimate kind of setting. And it meant that the actors who were on the stage didn't need to have amplification, that even the people sitting here are going to be quite close to the stage. So it's still that very intimate kind of setting that you would experience probably, even if it had been set up in a courtyard of an inn or something like that. Also, maybe the pictures that you will see will show to you that the background here often looked like the courtyard of an inn, too. So it kind of replicated what had been going on kind of naturally before. And then in establishing the theater, it actually looked like an inn. There were often windows of some sort that looked like an inn, so action could be coming from up in this area. People could be leaning out of the windows and talking to one another down the stage. Something I mentioned yesterday is that in England, women weren't allowed to act. So the women's roles were played by boys in the Elizabethan theater. This was not true in France. But in England, the women's characters were played by boys, which makes the play As You Like It a little bit more complicated or maybe more interesting, because the lead character, Rosalind, disguises herself as a boy in the play itself, and that makes some sense, I guess, because if she was actually a boy, she didn't have to don her girl's clothes. She could actually be dressed as she really was, as a boy, for most of the play. Some other things about special effects. I understand that battle scenes were performed very realistically, that gunpowder was used. There was a lot of sword fighting, a lot of spectacle. Maybe Michael can affirm this or not, but I had learned that one of the theaters actually burnt down during a performance because of some gunfire or gunpowder going off, and of course this is all made of straw and wood and that kind of thing. A number of these theaters did burn down. They suspect that some of that may have been the result of some of the spectacular special effects that were going on at the time. The other thing you can tell from this theater, which makes it different from the theater today, is that there weren't scenes were not changed. There's really no way to change the scene except by maybe bringing on new props, a new chair, a table, something like that, to suggest a new scene. That would be the next stage of the theater, when actual sets were brought in and out. But this theater didn't lend itself to that kind of thing. So again, imagination in developing the scene was real important. Yes?
Is the Theatre National an accurate replica of the old world, or some Elizabethan theatre?
Is what?
The Theatre at Ashland. Does that seem to be an accurate,
you know,
replica?
I haven't seen the Theatre at Ashland.
It's fairly as much as they know, as much as they can get accurate dimensions from them. That was the intention of building that slope.
We sit in the open there, so it rains.
You get wet.
The audience area there is not accurate, according to you.
No.
But the dimensions of the stage and the setup of the stage houses.
And did they amplify it, Ashland? I can't remember.
I don't think so.
And Ashland performs at night, don't they?
Yeah.
Don't they put
in
place at night?
Lights.
They have lights. Okay. So that just gives you a little bit of this is a bird's eye view of the Elizabethan theater, and I have a better picture of a sketch of what it actually looked like here, so that you can kind of see it front on. But if you've been at Ashland and that's what it looks like, you probably do have a good idea of what the stage itself looks like.
Okay.
Now, in terms of how Shakespeare was acted or what we know about it, most people suspect that the kind of style of acting that was done in Shakespeare's day was very declamatory and very stylized, and that the actors kind of belted their speeches out in spite of the fact that it was in a rather intimate setting. But the general thought of theater, I think for a long, long time, it's kind of a modern notion for us that we should play our scenes more realistically. And in fact, one author has written that anything approaching reality in drama is a failure. This was actually someone who wrote after Shakespeare's time. But I think that idea of you don't want theater to be real, you want it to be something super real or better than real in some sense. And so the performance was highly stylized. And I think we can get a good idea of what that was like because I don't know if any of you have read this or seen Hamlet, but in the play Hamlet, at one point Hamlet is going to put on, he's written a play that he wants to have performed for the king and his mother, and he's going to try to trap them by for you. So that you'll have an idea of what the acting was like. Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of our players do, I had as live the town crier spoke my lines. Nor do not saw the air so much with your hand thus, but use gently, for in very torrent, tempest, and as I say, whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it a smoothness. Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robust, periwigged, pated fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, and to spleet the ears of the groundlings, who, for the most part, are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise. We know something about our groundlings. I would have such a fellow whipped for o'erdoing termagant, and it out Herod's Herod. Pray you avoid it. The actor says, we'll do it, Your Honor. He says, but be not too tame either. But let your own discretion be your tutor. Suit the action to the word, and the word to the action, with this special observance, that you not o'erstep the modesty of nature. For anything so o'erdone is from the purpose of playing, whose end, both in the front and now, was and is to hold as 'twere the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, this form and pressure. Now this overdone, or come tardy off, though it makes for an unskillful laugh, cannot but make the judicious grieve, the censure of which one must in your allowance or away a whole theater of others. Oh, there be players that I have seen play, and heard others praise, and that highly, not to speak it profanely, that, neither having the accent of Christians, nor the gait of a Christian, pagan nor man, have so strutted and bellowed that I have thought some of nature's journeymen had made men, and not made them well. They imitated humanity so abominably. So reform it altogether, and let those that play your clowns speak no more than is set down for them. For there be some of them that will themselves laugh to set on some quantity of barren spectators to laugh too, though in the meantime some necessary question of the play must then be considered. That's villainous and shows a most pitiful ambition in the fool that uses it. Go make you ready. So I think you also get an impression of what some of the clowns in Shakespeare's plays did too, that they didn't follow the lines that Shakespeare had set down for them, and so he was kind of scolding them about not following their scripts. Turning to the play As You Like It itself, in looking, in just looking at any Shakespeare play, you can get some sort of a feeling for the characters that are involved by the type of language that's used in the play. And I would just like to point out that to you because I think it enhances, if you're just going to read a Shakespeare play, it enhances your understanding of the play to know a little bit about this. Although actually, when you hear the play, I don't think you would notice the difference. And there are kind of three types of language in a Shakespeare play. One is poetry, where you'll actually find a rhythm and a rhyme to the verse that's being spoken. And an example of that is in Act 3, Scene 2, beginning at about line 1, and basically continuing throughout this scene. If there are those of you that have it, you might want to take a look. I don't think we'll read this scene right now. But I will describe the scene for you so you can have some sort of understanding about what's going on here. In the story of As You Like It, Orlando, the lover, comes into the forest and is hanging a poetry that he's written for his loved one, Rosalind, on trees. And so the scene is a scene of her pulling the poems off of the trees and reading them out loud. Now, poetry in most of Shakespeare's plays is spoken either by supernatural characters, let's say the witches in Macbeth or the fairies in Midsummer Night's Dream. It's also used by people who are crazy, and in this scene, I think it's kind of lovely and clever what Shakespeare has done, because part of the idea, one of the themes in As You Like It, is that love makes you crazy, or love makes you kind of makes you lose your reason. And so there's a lot of rhyming, actually. There's a lot of poetry that goes on in the play. Poetry is also used, and this, again, I'm talking about rhyme and regular meter, is used to heighten or to bring emphasis to certain speeches. So sometimes characters who aren't crazy or who aren't supernatural will also maybe have a rhyming couplet in something they say. But that, again, is just to pull out that particular phrase and make it highlighted. A more common type of language in Shakespeare's plays is prose, just normal talking. And an example of this would be in Act 1, Scene 3. Beginning, again, about line 1, I think, beginning of that scene. Here we have Celia and Rosalind who are talking to one another. And this is it's a little bit unusual, because typically Shakespeare's more regal characters or his higher characters did not speak in prose. We mostly find prose in clown characters or low comedy kinds of characters who spoke the language of the groundlings. And sometimes when you're reading Shakespeare's plays, it's difficult to understand what's being said because it's in the vernacular and they're throwing in a lot of colloquialisms, I suppose, that Elizabethan people used with one another. But in this scene, this happens throughout As You Like It, if you just look at the way the page is set up, you can see that the margin is justified on the side. What they're talking here is prose. And then when you move to about line 40, the Duke Frederick comes in. And I would like to have us read this scene, because at this point, the language of the play shifts into iambic pentameter, which is a particular type of poetic rhythm, but it's not rhymed. And Shakespeare was famous for using this type of speech with his higher characters. Could I have someone who's looking on who could read Duke Frederick? Who are the people that have scripts so I can call on you? Would you read Rosalind, please? And would you in the back read Celia? I think she has a couple of lines here. And a Duke Frederick? Would you read the Duke? This is beginning on line 40.
You, cousin, within these 10 days, if that thou beast found so near our public court as 20 miles, thou diest for it.
I apologize, I don't have line. Oh, so I was starting at the beginning of Duke's entrance, so I'm
just down a couple of miles.
Yeah, it's not okay. Far from there.
You cousin. Okay. I'm missing it. Okay. Maybe it would be easier if someone had to.
Do you see where she says, I do beseech your grace?
It's only a couple.
We are in scene 3, act 1?
Yep.
Right after, it's like 2 lines after.
It's only with Mr.
Okay. I've got it now. Thank you.
You see it there?
It was just in a different light.
Why don't you give her a lead in again,
okay. Michael? Within these 10 days, if that thou beest found so near our public court as 20 miles, thou diest for it.
I do beseech your grace. Let me the knowledge of my fault bear with me, if with myself I hold intelligence, or have acquaintance with my own desires. If that I do not dream, or be not frantic, as I do trust I am not, then, dear uncle, never so much as in a thought unborn did I offend your highness.
Thus do all traitors. If their purgation did consist in words, they are as innocent as grace itself. Let it suffice thee that I trust thee not.
Yet your mistrust cannot make me a traitor. Tell me, whereon the likelihood depends.
Thou art thy father's daughter. There's enough.
So was I when your highness took his dukedom. So was I when your highness banished him. Treason is not inherited, my lord. Or if we did derive it from our friends, what's that to me? My father was no traitor. Then would, my liege, mistake me not so much to think my poverty is treacherous.
Dear sovereign, hear me speak.
Aye, Celia. We stayed her for your sake, else had she with her father ranged along.
I did not then entreat to have her stay. It was your pleasure and your own remorse. I was too young that time to value her. But now I know her. If she be a traitor, why so am I. We still have slept together, rose at an instant, learned, played, eat together. And wheresoever we went, like Juno's swans, still we went coupled and inseparable.
She is too subtile for thee, and her smoothness, her very silence and her patience speak to the people, and they pity her. Thou art a fool. She robs thee of thy name. And thou wilt show more bright and seem more virtuous when she is gone. Then open not thy lips. Firm and irrevocable is my doom, which I have passed upon her. She is banished.
Pronounce that sentence then on me, my liege. I cannot live out of her company.
You are a fool. You, niece, provide yourself. If you stay outside the time upon mine honor and in the greatness of my word, you die.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if you were able to hear in their reading, and I think they did a good job of catching kind of the rhythm of what's going on there. Just to pull one particular line or a couple of speeches here, Celia says, pronounce that sentence then on me, my liege, I cannot live out of her company. I mean, that's kind of the breaking it down into the strict way that it should be read, but there's a real pulse to it. And as I mentioned yesterday, that people who act in a Shakespeare company for a summer will kind of find themselves in regular conversation after a while, kind of talking to one another in iambic pentameter. It's a very kind of catchy, it's a beautiful way to write the English language. I think our language has syllables that lend itself naturally to this, and Shakespeare and the Elizabethans used by iambic pentameter a lot in their elevated characters. Now, it's interesting that in this play, when Celia and Rosalind, who are now being banished by the Duke, go into the Forest of Arden, they are speaking in prose, and that's because, not because they're low characters, but they are disguised as peasants when they go and hide in the forest, so their speech changes. So I just wanted to point that out to you, because I think when you're reading a play like this, it really enhances the understanding of what kind of role the characters are playing, and also what's going on for them personally in the play. And of course, at the end of the play, when Hymen comes in, and he's the supernatural character, remember, he's the god of marriage that probably has floated in on a chariot from heaven, he is speaking all in poetry. I mean, the whole scene is rhyming, and it's very, very lighthearted.